Welcome to this week's episode of Trista's Plate Story Podcast. I'm Trista Polo from iwokeupawesome.com, and I am your host. Each week, we learn the story behind that vanity plate. You know, the one you saw driving down the road? What did it say? What did it mean? Why did they choose it?
Welcome. I'm very excited to have Edward Yamielkowski from Knott's Island, North Carolina. He has two license plates, Mr. Ed and Why Not, and we're here to find out the story behind those plates. Welcome, Ed. Thanks for being here.
Great. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Yeah, I'm really excited. So let's just jump in and start with the story behind the license plates. Let's start with Mr. Ed. Why did you choose that plate?
Okay, well, Mr. Ed, it kind of goes back to when my children were young, and I would be involved in their activities, Girl Scouts, Little League, PTO. We were very active in a lot of school functions, and also I was, you know, around kids a lot. And with my last name being as long and difficult as it is, and people would try to avoid that, so they'd just call me Mr. Ed instead of Mr. Yamielkowski, when they'd be calling all the other parents, you know, Mr. and Mrs. by their last name. So I ended up being Mr. Ed.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and that stuck.
Yes, I agree. Your name is a mouthful.
It's 12 letters, but you know, the way you said it, it breaks down into four very distinct syllables that are very, you know, easily recognized, you know, yam, oil, cow, and ski.
Oh, yeah, that's very good.
I mean, it's pretty simple, actually. But when you see the whole thing in total, it's like, boy, that's a mouthful.
Yeah, it's a little Mount Everest name, actually. But when you break it down to four regular everyday English words that, you know, kindergartners learn, that's actually not that big a deal.
That's right.
That's awesome. And how about Why Not? And it's Y K N O T T. Tell us the story behind that plate.
So the Y is our first letter on our last name.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And then Knott from Knott's Island. And it's like, why not pick that? You know? So
why not be in Knott's Island?
That's right. Why not, you know? Yeah, that's correct. The funny thing with the Why Not is there's a chain of pizza restaurants down here called Why Not Pizza.
Oh, do people assume that that's their plate, that they own that plate?
Yeah, some people have said, oh, you associated with the pizza chain. No, not at
all. Maybe they could give you a good price for your license plate. Now, you moved to Knott's Island at retirement, is that right?
Yes.
And how long have you lived there?
We've lived here 6 years.
That's awesome. What made you choose Knott's Island over every other place that you could have retired to?
Well, our original intent was to move to Virginia Beach, the southern end of Virginia Beach, which is agricultural. And we have friends who have a horse farm there. So we've been telling them for years that as soon as we retire, we're coming down and going to help them with the horses. And so when we did retire, we were looking around for property, and the property values in Pungo, it was the Pungo section of Virginia Beach, very expensive. And we just couldn't find a place that was suitable to us. And right over the state line is Knott's Island. And our friend who has the horse farm had a sister who was in real estate, and she knew of this wonderful place that we bought. And so that's how we ended up on Knott's Island.
Wow, that's awesome. And I understand it's a beautiful place to live. Now, I have to tell a story really quickly how we connected, because I actually have also interviewed your daughter and done an episode with her for her license plate, which is Boof, B-O-O-F. And apparently all of you guys, you're a family of license plate, vanity plate owners.
Right.
Now, she told me about you before you and I spoke, and she talked about you as being like this really well-known guy that everybody loves in Knott's Island, that you're not the mayor, but that you are one of the prominent citizens. And so I was so excited to meet you, and you're clearly very gregarious and open and willing to have a conversation, of course, be on a podcast. But I was surprised when we spoke originally, you said that you used to be like an introvert who dealt with, you know, stage fright and didn't like to speak in public. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, and that started in kindergarten.
Wow.
I had anxiety as soon as I got into school. And me and the custodian got to be very friendly. because I'd have, you know, these anxiety attacks, and then all of a sudden breakfast was lost, and they'd be on the intercom.
Oh my goodness.
Calling the calling the custodian. And I carried that right through to the workplace as an engineer.
Wow.
The first couple of years of my career, I was having anxiety attacks at work. And everybody knew it. They'd say, oh, Ed's head is in the wastebasket again.
Oh, my goodness.
This is suitable for the broadcast. But, I mean, that's me.
Well, what do you think started it? Because that's a pretty high level of anxiety if it's actually causing you to have physical reaction like that.
Yeah, you know, I'm not really sure, but I just had an episode this last weekend when I messed something up for somebody on their wedding day. I was supposed to put up a sign on the marquee of the fire department, you know, congratulating this couple on their wedding, and I completely forgot to do it. And so the past couple days after that, I was actually having problems.
So the anxiety does come back.
It does come back. Yeah. I was surprised it came back that strongly, but I really did mess up. I mean, this was their wedding day.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you have a big heart. Yeah. I can tell you have a big heart and you just care a lot about people. So I can see why that would have really brought a lot of that back. And I'm sorry that you had to deal with that. You know, everybody makes mistakes, as you know.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, how did you go so 180 from living with this kind of anxiety to being somebody who's out there making a difference at lots of public functions and being so well-loved and well-known in your neighborhood?
Well, I think I just came down here and it's like, well, nobody knows me. You know, nobody knows that I'm shy or have anxiety or whatever. It's like, just try something new. And I just wanted to, you know, leave that behind, which I really haven't, but I did turn the page, you know?
Yeah. It's like you had the opportunity to reinvent yourself.
Yes.
And you did.
Yes.
And you chose to be somebody who's out there, social, friendly, able to talk to anybody, and you do a lot of public speaking in Knott's Island, right?
No, but I mean, I have done a couple of things, like I moderated Candidates Night a couple of times. You know, I belong to an organization called Ruritans, and we sponsored Candidates Night. And so everyone's looking at each other going, well, who's going to moderate this thing? You know, and it's like, well, I'm certainly not going to moderate it because, you know, I can't stand up in front of a group. And said nobody else would do it. So it's like, okay, let's give it a try. And I did it, and you know, it turned out okay.
It did, right?
Complimenting me for it.
Oh, that's great. So as a scared, stage fright public speaker, do you have any advice for people? Like, how did you go from, I'm not doing that, to, okay, I'll do it, and hey, that worked out better than I thought?
I guess just go for it. I mean, what's the worst thing that's going to happen? You know, I could tell you a couple of things that have happened when I've been up in front of people and whatever, when I've actually left to go to the restroom and, you know, take care of some business and take a little, I call a bird bath, put some water, you know, kind of splash it on you and cool yourself down.
Yeah.
Wipe off the best you can and go back in you and you're dripping and continue.
Wow. So that's happened to you when you've been public speaking before?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Oh my goodness.
For the most part, it worked. I used to go to a lot of meetings, but I'd just be very, very quiet, just try not to say anything and try not to get called on and kind of hide in the corner. And then after the business meetings were over with, I'd go conduct business like I should have been conducting business in the context of the meeting.
Wow.
I'd just do it all as sidebars. I mean, that's not the right thing to do, but I mean, that's how I coped, you know? That's
yeah. Yeah. And it worked for you. You were very successful and able to retire. So congratulations for that. Yeah. And we're going to talk a little bit about your career because I find it quite fascinating, but I want to stick with the Knott's Island conversation a little bit more because yes. You might not do a lot of public speaking, but you do a lot of public appearances in a bunny suit, as I understand it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the bunny suit, I mean, it was much like the being the moderator for the candidates night. It's like I was the last man standing. So we belong, my wife and I belong to the fire department auxiliary. And so they used to annually put on an Easter egg hunt in cooperation with the Baptist Church. So the first year we're there to do this Easter egg hunt, they bought a new bunny suit. And so, you know, it's half an hour to showtime, and they pull the suit out of the box, and I'm there, you know, it's a bunch of ladies, all kind of, you know, small. They pull this bunny suit out, and it's huge. And so they're looking around, okay, well, who's the bunny? It's like, well, I'm not the bunny. Certainly, I'm not the bunny. So it's like, hey, they have to be the bunny.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's like, oh, no. I said, so the first thing that I asked, does the bunny talk? They said, no, the bunny doesn't speak. Oh, okay.
Okay, then I'll do it.
You have to ride in the fire truck because the bunny arrives by fire truck. And that's cool.
That is very cool. I'm just having this picture. I've seen it in movies, you know, where they'll ask for a volunteer and everybody but one guy will step backwards one step and that guy ends up being the volunteer. That seems to happen to you a lot.
it certainly does. But I mean, but when you're in that situation, what are you going to do, right? You got to rise to the occasion. So, you know.
Absolutely.
You just do it.
Absolutely. So another thing I wanted to talk to you about with your Knott's Island experience, you actually got to work on a movie. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is another thing, you know, so I'm at a Raritan's meeting and the associate director of the producer rather of the movie is our secretary. And she says, well, I'm not going to be here the next 3 weeks because I'm filming a movie. Does anybody want to help film a movie? And so I says, yeah, I guess I do. So, you know, it's like, so I sent her an email and I figured all kinds of people are going to be putting in for this because how cool is that, you know, to get to film a movie? Well, I was the only one that
volunteered. Are you serious?
Only one.
Wow.
Like, well, okay. So I did it. So I went in as a production assistant. So that is, I just go do whatever they tell me to do, you know? And so this executive producer says, well, here's the ground rules. You don't get paid, but we feed you, and you do whatever we say. It's like, okay, I'll do it. So this is
a new experience
for me, right?
Yeah.
So this was pretty cool. And so I was doing all kinds of things, you know, cleaning up, yelling quiet on the set, you know, all kinds of fun stuff. And but then my role just sort of evolved, and I ended up being an extra in a couple of scenes. You can't really see me too much. I ended up being the caterer towards the end of the movie production and feeding, you know, 40 people or so.
Wow.
Meals and, you know, do all the shopping for it, cook it.
Oh my gosh.
And whatever.
You were food services?
Yeah, I was
crafty. Wow.
Crafty, as they called it. And so I did that. I mean, we did have a good caterer, but after most of the filming was done, we kind of transitioned into me being the caterer. It was like, well, who's going to feed us? I guess it's me. So it's like, because I used to do that in Girl Scouts. We'd hold these big camperies at these big campsites, and I'd be the one who would do all the cooking. You know, I'd serve 200 people or so, of course, with help, other volunteers. So it's like, well, I've fed large groups of people before, you know.
I could do it.
I was doing that.
That's so fun. I love that you're like, yeah, me, I'll do it. So tell me about this movie. What was the name of it? Who starred in it?
Okay, the name of the movie is Eyes of the Roshi. Okay, and it's about a Vietnamese individual, and he lives on the island here. Actually, I work with him. He's got a large property, like 70 acres here. And I help him maintain his property and whatever. He's an all-around good guy, but he's a yoga master. And so we call him Master Adam. And then Eric Roberts, he's known as one of the busiest actors in Hollywood. He does a whole lot of movies. And so he was pretty cool to work with. And he really liked my daughters. So my daughters were on the set a lot of the times. So all of a sudden, Eric, every time I'd see him, he'd come walking up to me, give me a hug, and he'd go, Dad.
Oh, that's so nice.
Like, well, that's pretty cool, you know?
I love that.
It was meant to be a martial arts action-type movie.
Got it. And,
so, you know, he's like my age, but he's in phenomenal shape.
I bet.
These yoga people, you know, they can lift them, their body up on one hand and crank their leg around their neck and all this type of stuff.
Yes.
He does it. I've seen him do it.
My husband always sees those and he thinks it's got to be Photoshop. There's no way a person could make their body do that.
And he's a teacher. He still teaches. And he's telling me that he's got students in their 70s that do that.
Wow, that's very cool. And so was Eric Roberts the villain? Like, what was the storyline?
Well, Eric Roberts ended up being a hitman, but he got shot. And unfortunately, the movie never was a theatrical release. I mean, you can get it on Amazon or...
Oh, okay. Or like Netflix, maybe.
Yeah, it was on Netflix for a while. And it was pretty cool.
I have to say, I love that you just went for it and you were part of this thing. And by being willing to do whatever they asked, you actually had this really fun experience in a lot of different areas of the movie production. I think that's great. Now, my more important question is, did you get a credit?
Oh, yes. I think I put in my notes that I have many credits on the screen, but I also have an internet movie database page.
Now you're somebody.
You can just look me up.
That's awesome. That is awesome. I'll make sure to put a link to your IMDb page on your show notes.
Yeah.
That's great. Now, I have to ask you about one other thing. You're apparently a very well-known baker around your parts, and you do a lot of baking for fundraising, etc. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. It's something that I had started back when I lived in Connecticut. I used to come home from work every night and bake 2 loaves of bread because that's what my recipe called for. I mean, the ingredients resulted in 2 loaves of bread. And so we couldn't eat 2 loaves of bread. So I used to bake them and then go to my neighbors, you know, kind of rotate. Here's a loaf of warm bread every night, you know. So I had this small group that I used to deliver bread to. So I got, you know, kind of known for that and people anticipating getting their warm loaf that night. And so I just kind of didn't really carry on the tradition down here, but I tried to keep up my bread baking skills. And so that kind of translated into people asking me, you know, if there was a fundraiser or whatever. Our local United Methodist Church has a big fried chicken dinner every year. And the pastor approached me and said, you know, I really love yeast rolls. She says, we've been purchasing rolls and, you know, it's not that great. I really would like some yeast rolls. She says, I heard you bake. And I said, not a problem, pastor. And so he says, well, how many do you need? She says, well, 300, 3 1/4. It's like, okay. Well, I bake them 20 at a time, you know, and I have a stand mixer and all. And so it's like, in order to make that many, it's a long 12-hour day and whatever, but it's a labor of love. And then when I see people after the chicken dinner, they're saying, oh, those rolls were great. Were those rolls yours? I say, yeah, those are mine. And so I get a lot of compliments.
That's awesome.
On them. I've even baked like communion bread for her, for the pastor. And she's used that in her services.
Wow. Oh my gosh, that's great. But you also like to bake with your grandkids. Is that right?
Yeah, I've got a now 3-year-old granddaughter, but when she sees me baking, you know, she puts on a little apron and she comes over to help me.
Yes.
But we have a lot of fun, and you know, she'll add the ingredients, and I'll rip off a piece of bread dough, and she'll roll it, and you know, mark it and pat it with a bee, you know, mark it with a bee, you know, the all that kind of stuff. And
from the nursery rhyme, yes,
nursery rhyme, you know.
Yeah.
And, so I'll give her own little cutting board where she can roll it all out, and all. And actually, I have some biscuit cutters, the circular cutter, and she'll do those and make her own little biscuits and stuff.
That's awesome. You'd given me a picture of yourself along with your plate picture, and it looked like maybe you'd had a little too much fun with the stand mixer. Was that making rolls for the church, or was that with your granddaughter?
No, we were making biscuits, and like buttermilk type of biscuits, and I was adding some dough into the stand mixer, and it kicked back on me and got all over me. And my wife took a picture of it. And Audrey actually got a little bit of flower on her too. I didn't send a picture of Audrey, but I've got a real nice picture of her with her face kind of covered in flower. But we have fun.
You know? That's awesome. It sounds like you do have fun. You get to spend a good amount of time with your grandkids, right?
Yeah, they live with us while they're still waiting to build a house. They've got a piece of property, but you know, times being what they are. And I'm going to tell you, to be able to see your grandchildren every day is just awesome.
You know? Yes, I bet. That's probably one of the best parts of retirement, right?
It really is. You know, when I hear friends or whatever saying, you know, I got grandchildren in Texas or California or whatever, when haven't seen them in a long time, it's like, you know, I wouldn't trade this for the world.
Yeah, it makes you feel really lucky and blessed that you have that.
We are blessed.
Yeah. Now, you haven't always been retired. You actually had quite an amazing career. You said you were an engineer. You worked with the Navy in a shipyard. Tell me about your experience as an engineer.
Yeah, let me just back up one step. As soon as my wife and I got married, we went to Maryland, and I worked for the Navy at an ordnance plant where they made nitroglycerin and all kinds of high explosives and all. And so we lived right outside of the Washington, D.C. area.
Wow. And
we didn't like it. We didn't like it. And then my wife was always hearing stories like, well, every now and then the ordnance plant blows up, you know? So it's like, okay. So I had a 5-year plan of staying down there. She had a 2-year plan. I'll give you 2 years.
Yeah, well, yeah.
On the 25th month, I got another Navy job, and it was back in New England. And so she was now able to, you know, be close to family and all. And it was in the submarine business at Electric Boat, but I was still a Navy employee. All right. And so it was kind of a safer environment.
Yes.
And it met a lot of needs for us. We wanted to be back with family. We love New England, but we didn't want to necessarily go back to our hometown.
Sure.
Which was
absolutely
Massachusetts, which we just never cared to be there. So we settled in Groton, Connecticut. We were there for 32 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And you worked on submarines.
I worked on submarines. Of course, I didn't know anything about submarines as I went into the job. And so going back to anxiety. So that's why I had a lot of anxiety the first several years, because they had a lot of expectations on you. And the submarine world is very technically challenging, very rigorous standards.
How did they prep you for this level of rigor?
Yeah, they really didn't. I mean, it was mostly learn on the job. And there's a lot to learn, you know. And of course, the business is always, like any technology, it's always kind of evolving. And, you know, as part of the job, I mean, we did several phases. I mean, we were involved in design. We built the ships. We repaired the ships. And we converted them. I mean, we converted some Trident missile ships into other type of ship. And so, I mean, it's very, very challenging, exciting, always something new.
That's very cool. Now, you were not part of the military, so you didn't go out on missions and things, but did you ever have an opportunity to be on any of the submarines and experience what it was like to live on them?
Yeah, I went on several sea trials, and those were very interesting experiences.
Yeah, tell me about that. I've toured them in you know, museums,
yeah,
but I've never been in one underwater. So what's it like to live on a submarine?
Well, quarters are kind of cramped. Passageways and stuff, I mean, you got to be able to really like the people that you're with, because you're always making physical contact with them down some of the passageways. And, you know, like when you're in the mess hall eating, I mean, you can barely move your elbows. At least that was my experience. I mean, they kind of cram you in there. And so quarters are kind of tight. I did okay on the sub. The only time I had problems was when they're on the surface. I have problems with motion sickness. And
really? So it's worse on the surface than it is underwater when it comes to motion sickness?
Yeah, the darn thing bobs like a cork when you're on the surface. And, you know, because it doesn't have any, it has a few appendages, but not many to really kind of keep it stable. You know, they have ways of stabilizing, you know. But when the submarine is submerged, I mean, it's like sitting sitting here, you know? You know, no sensation.
Yeah.
You know, when they pitch up or pitch down, you know, if they're submerging or, you know, when you're ascending. I mean, you can feel that, but it's not much more than like being on an airplane.
Right. I do notice on an airplane, you can't really tell that you're this, you know, that you're at an angle going up. There's really not much difference. I always wonder when we're tipped over, turning, why am I not leaning this way on the right or the left? So it's probably similar in a submarine when you're under.
Yeah, in that degree of roll and stuff and pitch isn't that great. Plus, you have no frame of reference, you know, like, except if, you know, if the plane is banking and you're looking out the window.
Right.
You know,
right.
All of a sudden, you know, you lose the horizon and all you can do is see what's below you. Then all of a sudden, it's like, oh, okay.
Now I know what's going on.
Now I know what's going on. Yeah. No sensation of that in the sub.
Sure. Did you ever have any experiences when you were on the sub where anything would happen, any like emergencies or things that could affect? Because, you know, you're in the submarine, you're underwater. If something bad happens, you sort of have to handle it. Did you ever have any experiences like that? Or was that mostly when they were on missions?
No, I was on a sea trial where we actually had a couple of small fires. We had some flooding into the boat. And when we had somebody do a bad lineup on the sanitary system and they blew the sanitary tanks.
Oh my gosh. And you're underwater and you're out. What do you do?
The first time it happened, you could effectively put your handkerchief over your mouth and nose and walk around like that for a few days until the smell dissipated. But right before we were coming in, like maybe 2 days before we were coming in, it happened again. And there was,
oh my goodness,
no escaping the, you know, the odor and whatever. I mean, it was pretty.
Right, because where would it even dissipate to? There's no place for it to go.
You know, they can clean the air and that type of stuff. You know, they generate their own oxygen. They have.
So they have filters and things.
Right, because you
okay.
You know, carbon monoxide and stuff out of the air. So, you know, we do have, you know, equipment to go do that. But really, it was pretty bad. But I mean, it's a good experience. You know, I enjoyed being out at sea, and when I did it as a senior engineer, I had the luxury of saying, "Well, I'm going to stay in my rack while the boat is on the surface, because I can handle that." And as soon as I surge, I'd get up and about, and I was, you know, I could do my business. But as a junior engineer, I couldn't do that. So I did go out a couple times as a junior engineer, and I had to be on my feet, and that didn't work out too well.
No, I wouldn't think so.
I'm going to tell you, I loved the submarine business, and I dream about it every night.
So I have really loved chatting with you and learning about your life, your history, and how much you are really living your retirement. You know, I hear so many times where retirees will just sort of decide that since they're no longer working, it's almost like they're no longer living. And that is definitely not you. And so I really acknowledge you for that, because every stage of our lives, we have a choice how much we show up and how much we participate. And you are doing that. So that's wonderful. And I'm sure your kids and grandkids really appreciate that about you as well.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
They
do. Great. So I always like to wrap up with turning the tables, giving you an opportunity. I've been asking you all these questions. Do you have a question for me before we end?
Well, actually, I had to change my question, but I do. Do you have any musical talent?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. So I grew up in a very musical family. My family is extremely talented. I have a cousin who's a professional French horn player. His wife is a concert pianist. Their children are both professional flautist and viola players. Just like a really, my uncle is a jazz saxophone player. Just an amazingly musical family. So when I was growing up, I was put into piano lessons. I played the flute for a while in high school. I played the trombone for a while in high school. And I never had the discipline to practice enough to become great at any of it. Mm-hmm. And I really, when I was younger, I really just wanted to rely on my natural talent. So my natural talent is as a singer. And so I grew up having a very naturally good voice. I was complimented all throughout my life, lots of solos in school and things. And I never did anything with it professionally, but I definitely enjoyed being a singer in any venue that I could. And so when I was working in New York City for several years for an advertising agency, my boss was a musician, he was a singer and a guitar player. And he had a 60s band on Long Island where he lived. And he asked me if I would be their singer. And so for a couple of years, I was actually a singer for a 60s band. I would travel down to Long Island on Saturdays to rehearse with them. We did some originals. We did a lot of 60s covers. We performed in bars and auditoriums and, you know, smaller venues, but a lot of live performance. We did some recording and we collaborated on some music that we wrote together.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Thanks for asking. What a great question.
Yeah. So I'm glad I asked that.
Me too. I really appreciate you asking that because I haven't talked about that in a long, long time. Ed, I have had such a blast chatting with you and learning about you and the story behind your license plate and everything else we covered as well. I want to thank you for being on. Do you have any final words you'd like to share before we wrap up?
No, not really. I mean, I was high anxiety anticipating this, you know, all of this. But I really don't. I enjoyed it.
Good.
And another opportunity for me to put myself out there.
I love it.
So,
well, you did a great job. You shared some wonderful stories, quite entertaining. And I'm so glad that even though you were having some anxiety, that you showed up and you did your best. And it's been a real pleasure.
It's a key word, show up. You know, that's the key to life.
You are so right.
Show up.
Absolutely. What a great way to end. Good final thought. Okay. Thanks, Ed. Have a great day.
Hey, you too, Trista. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of Trista's Plate Story Podcast. Please subscribe to Trista's Plate Story Podcast to get the story behind all those vanity plates driving with you on the road. And if you would like to nominate the owner of a license plate, including you, or visit any of our partners and sponsors, come and see us at platestory.com. That's PL8story.com, and give us the details. If you enjoyed this episode, please drop a review and give us a share. I'm Trista Polo, wishing you well on the road to your next adventure.